welcome to this episode of Talking Ghana. Talking Ghana is a podcast devoted to the left, right, and center of Ghanaian politics. For each episode, I join my friends Mami, Papa, Nelson, and Oliver to offer our take on the key issues and themes shaping Ghanaian politics. My name is Otin, a shorthand for Kwabena Otin Achambo. Many of you will know me as a lawyer and a human rights advocate. To that resume, you may add a development critic. I am very excited and privileged to be one of your co-hosts for this podcast. Thank you for sharing your precious time with us.
That is a problem.
Okay, so I'm interested in going back to fixing the country. So I have a number of questions, and Oliver, you can start with anyone you want to, and Papa, how do you connect from the virtual space of social media to the more deliberative space in the trotter, in the taxis, and in the markets, so that it'll connect to ordinary people, it'll connect to, in fact, let me rephrase the phrase ordinary people, because there are ordinary people deliberating in the virtual space and in social media. What I mean is, will expand beyond the platforms of the virtual spaces to more concrete deliberative spaces, like in the culture, in the marketplaces. That's the first thing. The second thing is a question that I asked before, and Kwame, I want you to address well. How do we then still appreciate that it will take a certain form of contentious and competitive politics to reform what we want to reform, the structural issues that we want to reform? And that will include political leadership. And so in that sense, how should the NDC position itself, and what should be the MPP response? What should be the approach of government now into understanding that these issues all go back to addressing, if you want it to be, the very structural issue that they claim they want to also address and they are working to address? And then the third thing is, how do we prevent institutionalizing this so that it will become the same of the past, where it will be so politicized that those who have initiated this will then ultimately grow a certain distrust in the system? So these are broad issues that I want us to do. To address, and Oliver, you can take any one of them.
So let me start from the last one, because I do know that there's something that comes up quite a bit about political projection of certain individuals into political spaces, become co-opted by the system they are looking to change, and then they ride on the momentum on the tails of a particular movement, and then that's it. We saw the same thing happen with Occupy Ghana. You know, I think that we all have to acknowledge a limitation we have, which is that we can only interpret the future with a template of the past. And then, I mean, it's only human nature. Our imaginations cannot extend beyond what we have seen before. And by this, I mean previous groups have consistently given us that template, and where people mobilize around a number of issues, and then we see them co-opted into government, and it becomes that. Government has sort of become sort of the only attractive place for people who are politically minded and ambitious to find themselves, rather than
nothing wrong with that.
So that they find themselves in all kinds of different spaces. Now, you would say there's nothing wrong with that, and perhaps there's legitimate truth to that. But the problem is that over time, it also has its downsides. The downside is that it has created a continuous disengagement by ordinary people, for lack of a better word, with this any project to reform the system, because they continuously see themselves as being used as a fuel to project others. And we have to recognize that historical baggage
and the way down, in which let down.
Yes, the lockdown that happened. We have to recognize that historical baggage in the way in which people will be looking at you cautiously and looking at it tentatively and trying to keep a certain distance and trying to understand where your motivations are. And one of the things I have found in trying to have this conversation and push this is recognizing that there's a genuine also in the country lack of confidence in the people's belief in their own voices to effect change structurally and like real structure. You know, like even when you think about how you transition into democracy, it had to be a wind of change generally blowing up after the fall of the Berlin Wall. It seemed like there was very little appetite internationally for, you know, these movements. It wasn't necessarily organic and driven from Ghana up, as some people like to believe, or that we give so much credit to Edubuahin's speech about culture of silence. It wasn't that organic. It was a sense of reading the international environment and seeing that we need to reshape ourselves. And so let's remove the P at the end of PNDC and then recoin what NDC means, and then we have a democracy. So let's put that in context. So people have never really seen themselves leading that structural change from the masses into and see it accumulate into something. The bigger, the only closest example you might be was the process leading to independence generally. And maybe even the challenge against Kutu Achampong's UNIGOV, but even that petered out in a way in which the Rawlingses and co had to come in. So let's acknowledge that people haven't seen certain things we are talking about, some of the things that people are hoping for from this move, from this. And that confidence gap is something that we must work to breach and get people to make dissent fashionable, to make people constantly believe that they can also be in the streets and it will accumulate into something, a bigger project. The second thing is that Nelson talks about how, you know, it hasn't connected, it hasn't done this, and hasn't that. I honestly think that, yes, it is a bubbling up moment. And I always tell people to temper their expectations and also watch it cautiously do this. Yesterday, I wrote a long post about how the whole of yesterday, I rejected all public media engagement because I was tired of the PRO kind of interview style. We need to be much more critical than that. Engage me on the basis of history, law, economics, philosophy. Ask me about what is the viability of a citizen mobilization. Ask me about the risk of petering out of movements like this. Let's have those hard conversations like we're doing here on Talking Ghana. So that conversation is not happening in our ecosystem, you know? And that's one of the bigger frustrations for me. So yes, I acknowledge that as this is bubbling up, we don't really know how the beast is going to lie, whether it's going to look like former ones or it's going to be a true revolution in the sense. Even for revolutions that have happened in Egypt and other places that did lead to changes of government were eventually also co-opted by politicians. The risk of co-option exists. The risk of people who are politically ambitious and want to use it to maintain the same system quo, the two-party structure that incentivizes others and excludes others. People also would want to use this. All those dangers exist. But we have to be careful, and that's why I continue to use, I describe myself as an accidental convener, that we don't pin all the things we hope from out of this moment on individual people within who are trying to do this. We want everybody else to join and participate in that conversation and project all these goodwillings and how they want this thing to go so that they can continue to solidify. That's the only way it can work. I cannot promise and deliver change. If that's what we're asking for, we're again building a movement around personalities rather than, you know, an organic process. Now, about the offline of online divide and moving this from the virtual space into the street. I have described the protest.
Not necessarily
to connect with people.
Yes. To connect with. Yes.
So I'm using streets as in that
okay. Way.
I have described the protest march as a street level legitimacy buying that we have to download the online to the offline. So that downloading process needs to happen. And that is where they are blocking us at. You understand? And perhaps they we are perhaps looking at them like they don't really understand what is going on. But perhaps they have analyzed what is the level at which on a daily basis over 600,000 people are tweeting these things only on Twitter and realize that if this is unleashed into people's communities, they might react to it differently.
But does it have to, that does the offloading has to take the form of a demonstration?
It has to happen. One, a demonstration is peculiar because of our history. But two, also, because so that it doesn't get overly diluted. Now, you're relying on traditional media to do that translation process. There's so many people who are excluded from the off the online space. There's some of, I mean, even on this call, I don't think until you tweet or on Twitter or active on Twitter.
I don't.
There's so many, yes. So there's so many segments of our society that are not in that virtual space.
Sorry, Oliver, but it's also, to vent. You don't vent by tweeting, you vent by going on the street and venting. That's the key expression.
It's cathartic.
If I should come in, I think we are taking a very narrow view of the potential repertoires of collective action that are at our disposal. Oliver, you may not have the protest may not even take place, but the fact that you are still rubbing off against the IGP and various institutions of the state, that interaction itself conveys a much more deeper meaning than just you writing a petition and others. And I think you should take a much broader view of the things within your arsenal that you can and people organize things like just wear red on Fridays. Rally around the flag, different means of protestations that you can adopt, rather than this, viewing the repetitors within just occupying a certain space on a particular day, as significant as they are, you may not get it, but I like the fact that interaction with the various institutions of the state are taking place. And think more creatively about ways in which you can expand the frontiers of interaction. How do you engage? I've told Otin, for me, if I'm thinking of associational politics in Ghana, and I think something that really the PNDC did extremely well, which enabled them to really dominate the political space as long as they did, connecting with the transport sector, the trotter drivers, the taxi, because those spaces, people boarding trotter, and when they get there, the first point, the guy goes, he wants to pay 2 cedis for the fare, and he's told, no, it's 2 cedis, 50 pesos. That frustration starts, it gets into the vehicle. That deliberative space there is extremely important. And change do happen. People get socialized, people's anger gets filtered and collectivized within those spaces. And I think thinking about those pockets of deliberative spaces and thinking about ways by which you could interact and engage, it's much, much more important than what will happen on May 9 or May 11, because we've had too many demonstrations in Ghana, which never really had an impact. Think more in terms of strategic engagement with various pockets of deliberation and various spaces where you can really keep the conversation going over time.
Oliver will come in, but I think...
I said, and still unstructured.
Exactly, and still unstructured.
But the tension, it raises the tension which Oliver hinted at on leadership and culture. Do you anticipate this as embedding in a culture of protest as kind of agency that, creates awareness for yourself and pushes you to push the government? And the tendency that, pushing all the hopes and aspirations of this kind of thing on leader or set of leaders, then, objectifies this onto a group of people and then creates an apathy. And I think you still need to straddle the two, yeah, because you need leadership to galvanize, but you need an embedding of the issues within the agency of the people to continue to push this and agitate it. And I think that is something that, you know, we all have to think about.
Yeah, but Papa, that does not necessarily, I agree with you, straightism will be good, but it doesn't necessarily have to be an assembly of the people on the street marching from Independence Square to wherever. If you are able to get and connect to more expanded deliberative spaces, you get a buy-in of transport. And if even for 4 hours, 6 hours, up to midday, trotter drivers say they are not going to work, sit down, and they are not necessarily going to march on the street, just a sit down, that will have an effect. That in itself will have an effect. And so that expansion...
As a reaction to the excuse of COVID, I totally agree with you. But I think you still will need a moment, an event, or sets of it within these kinds of deliberative spaces thing that I totally agree with.
But you need... The moment has already taken place. You see, episodes... The moment is that we are actually talking about it. What happened? What made us to even start talking about fix the country?
I'm telling you the comradeship that arises from gathering, being together, sharing thick bread, sharing pain, that comradeship of gathering is key to continuing the momentum in any struggle, either on the streets or on social media, or other deliberative spaces.
Exactly.
So I'm not disagreeing with the point about deliberative, especially now that COVID may be a hinder to gathering. But we cannot, and I don't think you guys are doing that. I don't think you are discounting it. I just want to emphasize that, you know, the coming together, the networking physically, sharing the struggle together, giving hugs, you know, being chased, that creates a certain togetherness that you don't get by just isolation, you need to think about that, you need to have that in mind.
So, and the point is that, you know, you can think of this in phases, and I think Oliver's account of what has gone on is very important in that regard. So the first phase, the virtual space, I think they've really done well there. Then and that has led them to move into the media space, where now on radio and on TV. And yesterday I came up with this big, I just said this thing that Papa made me feel bad, so I don't want to repeat that. But I think what happens is that when that media space is captured by people who will find themselves within what would often be described as epistemic community, then that could...
You then, said it's epistemic.
Epistemic. But I think people always need the raw materials to act with. You know, what is it that we are angry about, for instance? You know, so by shaping the debate in the media, and I think they've done well, the challenge really is how do you then move to the next phase?
Or how do you prevent the media from framing it for you, telling your story for you, rather than you allowing the 600 people to speak their own voices?
Exactly.
600,000 people.
The challenge now is how do you then translate that into spatial, you know, like physical space where people can concretize the very issues that you've abstracted on Twitter and on the media into their own lives. And I think that's where Papa's point about, you know, collective meetings, physical spaces, doing things would then concretize the thing. But I just had a quick response to some of the questions that Oten asked about how do we, you know, in terms of thinking about policy and political leadership, how does this moment translate into certain things, and I just I'll just go back to what the president said on January 7, 2017. In that speech, the president urged Ghanaians not to be spectators, but to be citizens. I know that thing was plagiarized, but I think it's a very profound thing. What does the president think when he views Ghanaians as citizens? For me, and sometimes I find myself in trouble when I say this, citizenship is really essentially a bundle of entitlement. I, as a Ghanaian, expect to be treated within Ghana in a certain way. I expect my government to act in a certain way. And if the government does not provide that, I have every right to protest and make noise in whatever form. In fact, I have every right not to provide a solution. All I can do is just scream. And the president has every right to listen. And if he thinks that that is not good, that's fine. But you cannot really take away that. I think the problem we have over, and it's not just the president, Akufo-Addo, but in our democratic journey, we've erected barriers to the effective exercise of citizenship. For instance, one of the barriers you can think of in this instance is the police. The police, rather than facilitating, I'm not a lawyer, but I do know that you are just not required to secure a permit per se for a rally. It's just a notification, sort of, to the police. Over time, we've interpreted that to mean that the police would essentially have to authorize a public gathering before that happens. But that is really not in sync with the spirit of the act. Similarly, we have and we've made that point here. I think Otin was the one who made it a while ago. Even if you look at the 1992 Constitution, the courts and true policies, we've interpreted it in ways that have become extremely restrictive and quite obstructive to the exercise of constitutional liberties. But bringing back this back to my own research, I think one of the most dangerous barriers we've erected is through this sort of technocratic discourse that we always want to deploy. So it is not just enough for market women to organize and say that the prices of cocoyam or plantain are rising too much. We expect them to, in addition to protesting about the prices, to tell us how they are going to fix it. And for some reason, if they are not able to come up with those answers, that protest then gets legitimized. I think citizenship requires that as Ghanaians, we continuously expand the frontiers of the ways in which we complain about how government delivers the goods that they themselves are expected to do that. And that is where Fix Ghana now is.
You're getting a lot of nods. You're getting a lot of nods from Oliver and myself. But
let me rub this in then.
There are very few occasions that Nelson and I agree on things. So I have to take this in.
Yeah. Let me then rub this in, because when you bring citizenship, Article 41 then comes in, responsibilities of the citizens. And it is in that regard, even though it's not been presented well, and it's been presented arrogantly, it is in that regard that in certain quarters, you have the sense that others are saying that we need a certain attitudinal change. If we desist from paying bribe, the receiver will not be in a position to receive that bribe. If we refuse to pay the bribe, that policeman on the street will not have the opportunity to collect a bribe. So in what way can we also, if I can borrow the word, but respectfully, fix our own selves, so that, and can you connect it to the fact that at the end of the day, all these structural and reforms that we are talking about will have to take place within the context of a certain political party structures. That, unfortunately, is the democracy that we have bought for ourselves and we are practicing. So what should the MPP do? What should the NDC do?
So this would
also I refuse to engage in this fix yourself narrative, to be honest. Because I do think that the time and why it is coming up now in the context of the conversation, we need to put it in context. We've been asking
a lot of questions. I agree with you. I am not.
So I think that even discussing it personally, I mean, others might disagree. Okay. Personally, I think that even discussing it finds a way in which we frame it into a legitimate context, and we decontextualize it where it's coming from. So it connects in ways in which I am unable to engage with. That's sort of my general feeling.
And you see, the point that I made earlier, government cannot, or President Akufo-Addo cannot fix Ghana now. In fact, fixing Ghana is much broader.
Mm-hmm.
But as I said, the government has to set the tone.
Okay. I
at the moment, I think that fix yourself moves the responsibility. It's essentially, for me, it's even much more dangerous. It's government shirking its responsibility of changing the government. I think there's the cultural thing. There's a governmental culture that is webbed around impunity and so many things that needs to be dealt with at a governmental level.
Mm.
I would say, you know, the president has changed the government a little. We are seeing more younger people. There are new ministers. Maybe we need to see the tone that they set. I really like what the Jinapo is doing at the Lands and Natural Resources.
Mm.
With the Galamsey fight, right? So over time, they should see this as an opportunity to really find ways by which they can really set the right tone for the country. I think at the moment, people feel a sense of dissatisfaction with government, and they have every right to express and articulate that. They may not articulate it in the ways that we like or that we can find comprehensible or logical, but contentious politics, as I always say, should be embedded in the policy process. If you have a government that would tell people who are going to seek a permit from the IGP and drag them to face the big boys and be sort of institutionalized the way that they sought to do, then that doesn't really resolve the problem.
And I think this answers my question, because if government and political parties set the tone, whichever, it will then rally.
No. I think you guys are mischaracterizing, misapprehending fix the country. As I understand it, fix the country is a strong pushback against the political class. There's nothing they can fix themselves about.
Okay.
Especially if you look at the pictures that are emerging, you know, as the second phase or whatever, second leg or, you know, of fix the country.
Name and shame.
Precisely. So in my mind, and Oliver can correct, I'm sure they themselves, you know, cannot even characterize it, you know, kind of fully, but they are clear in their minds, and I totally agree. And that's my understanding as well, that it's a pushback against a political class that just dances back and forth in and out of power, and without doing anything, you know, for the generality and masses of the people.
And I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
That's how so the question of fix yourself is totally misplaced. I mean, as a response to this, totally.
And everyone has his work cut out for them for this.
Yeah. The second thing
has to fix, you know,
in rounding up, the second thing is that, you know, this perhaps also signals a certain generational takeover or change. You have Akufo-Addo representing a certain generation of Ghanaian leaders, and perhaps if you look at the political landscape, that perhaps he's the last. You have Rawlings passing away, you know, and you have new leaders emerging. Perhaps, you know, and every generation has gone through this, and perhaps...
Are you sure we will not have the anybody above 70 running for presidency and winning again?
I don't see that currently. I'm just saying that perhaps this is also a way... perhaps we need to reflect this as well, you know, in the discussions of Fix the Ghana, and if Fix the country is can put itself in this place of being the generational shift, providing the generational shift in governance and leadership. Last, protests are only, you know, protests only provide you a standoff, right? Of course, I agree with Nelson, you need deliberation and policy to bring the actual change. And I think, but if you forget, if you lose protest and agitation as the one that gives you the currency to have something out of the deliberation, you miss it totally, especially if you are not the one who holds power. So kudos to Fix the Country. Oliver, we are behind you and we'll continue to support.
Will you have some concluding words, Oliver?
I think if I was any concluding words, and I do hope that a lot of people who sympathize with this and are also involved in planning this out, it might be more addressed to them. For me, I think we have raised the conversation to this point. It's a difficult struggle for the long term. It involves a lot more sacrifice than we've been able to give to this point. I mean, whether it's material, personal, financial, all of this entails, I mean, you may see little has been done, but all of this has entailed a lot of financial burden on people bearing this and carrying this forward. And I just kind of want to recognize the efforts of people who have been given, young people especially, who have given themselves a chance to believe that they could do something. You know, when we did the Jerry episode, and I reflected on the fact that young men of 20 years old and others had a sense of purpose about what was going wrong in their country. And at the time, the only ways they could participate in the conversation was raising guns. Now we have a different charter. We have a different way in which we can shift culture and through dialogue and through the use of our voices with the promises that are, the things that our constitution promises and our democracy promises. I hope that we're able to continue to channel that and let it have the impact that we want to see and that it becomes a generation that we are proud of.
Interestingly, that is the generation Papa is referring to as being the generation that need to shift focus to a new generation. For 40 years or so, it is that same generation, whether it was people involved in the military regime or people opposed to it, it is that same generation that has shaped everybody, everything in Ghana. And we find ourselves in the situation that we still find ourselves. And so it is a good thing that you are involved in. It is a good thing that is happening in the virtual space. We just hope that it will not be structured and institutionalized so that it will take the shape and form of protests of the past, but it will trickle down to those other deliberative spaces that will help it catch fire. And it will then put the political class on alert, both sides of the political divide, that the citizen is now very active and aware of the right and what the citizen is entitled to, and that we are going to voice our frustration for them to work for us. Thank you very much for listening and see you next 2 weeks. You want to say something, Nelson?
I didn't have my last word, but
have your last word. Have your last word, and then you can sign off.
I'm probably going to sign off on a very. I think we should temper our expectations. I've already said I don't think next year or even in a few weeks people might be talking about Fix Ghana. Hopefully,
people will still be talking about it.
No, so because you see, if you are expecting to still talk about Fix Ghana in a year, you really lose the point. The point is that over time, social movements emerge and fizzle out. That is the logical progression. Now we know there's Oliver, there's leadership coming up. It will get, you know, diluted over time, and perhaps we may not even be talking about Fix Ghana as a movement or even the Fix Ghana hashtag. All it takes is some local celebrities posting a nude picture and the conversation would change. The point really is not to survive as a movement. The point for me is you leave residues that linger on in the minds of people that they can always draw on and shift the culture in ways that will make people believe in their ability to effect change. And I think Oliver is really spot on that. That and I will even take it a bit further. The president, President Akufo-Addo, should look at his younger self when he was at Legon, when he and people like Mills had a group where they really used to think about the future that they wanted to build for Ghana and how that drove their action and the ways in which he engaged with politics over time. And that is how I see the young people. They may call it Fix Ghana now, but the next time is going to be something else. And we have to give them that space. We have to respect that right that they have. And in that regard, I would also add, Oliver, thanks for really helping drive this and all the sacrifices. We are solidly behind you.
Okay.
This was an exciting one.